Sitting in a living room, sitting on the porch. It's your words, gonna light that torch. Tell it in a city park, tell it in a bar, tell it in the backseat of your grandma's car. No tales too pure, our failures lure. The poor house sure wants to hear what's bubbling in your brain.
Welcome back to Tales from the Poor House. This is show two of On the Edge of International Falls.
Connor Malloy was born and raised in Mankato, Minnesota. He works at Ronsberg Technology. Connor.
I'm driving up to International Falls because we are pitching to Falls Memorial Hospital. And Falls Memorial is not the kind of account you just pitch over the phone. I work for Ronsberg Technology Partners. In a nutshell, we protect critical data. Have you ever had a flash drive? You back up your most essential information on it. What we provide is a really big flash drive for a college or a business, or in this case, a hospital. All those files, there's no point in selecting a few that are the most precious, so we back everything up, every file. We offer the hardware, the software, and most importantly, the know-how to transfer the data. I personally do none of that. I just get clients on board. I also puked in the bed last night, and my girlfriend told me to sleep on the couch, and when I sobered up, she kicked me out of the house. Ronsberg Technology never asks a customer to make a buying decision based on mythical spreadsheets that are based on hypothetical concepts. That's where I come in. That's why I'm on my way to International Falls, but all I can think about is Melissa. She had been mad at me before, but it was nothing like this. She had to wake up at 4 in the morning, clean out the sheets, and I barely remembered it. All I have is this hazy image of her screaming at me. But in my memory, it's on mute. I can't hear the words she is saying. All I can see is the absolute hatred in her eyes. That's why I've made her this mix. The first song is My Father's Gun by Sir Elton John. I put this on the mix because I know that Melissa likes that. When there's a pause in the lyrics and then they slam the drums a few times, usually ending on a hi-hat before the singer comes back, Melissa's a sucker for that. I put this song on here because it seems like a dancing song, and Melissa likes dancing. I never danced with her enough. It's a bit disturbing that that last sentence was in past tense, but this might have been the last straw. What does that even mean, the last straw? I should have danced with Melissa more. First night that Melissa invited me back to her house, she put Raekwon on her record player. Show me a man in the world that could resist a girl who likes Raekwon. This is a deep cut. I don't know if Melissa will make the connection, that is, if I ever give her the mix. I actually knew Melissa when I was in grade school. We were both friends with this family called the Harrisons. She was friends with Jessica Harrison, and I lived on the Harrisons' block. I'd always go over and play sports with her two little brothers. A lot of kids on the block did. One time, we were playing football, and Melissa was there. This is always the first memory I have of her. We were 12 and playing football, and Jessica and her were sitting on their parents' front steps. It was getting dark, and the streetlights started coming on. One of them was having trouble, though. It was flickering, but couldn't quite turn on all the way. Without saying a word to each other, all of us stopped what we were doing, put our hands on our chest, and started singing the Star Spangled Banner. By the end, the light was shining bright. The Harrisons had a cousin who lived with them, and he really liked T-Rex. That was what this reference was. Yeah, Melissa will never make that connection. At this point, there's only one song left on Melissa's mix, but I'm at Falls Memorial Hospital. I get the sale. I tell them, imagine, your garage is on fire. If you only had seconds to spare and could save just two or three valued possessions, what might they be? Not many of us would gamble on things of significant value, but that's exactly what many businesses do. We have a better way. In the parking lot, I listen to the last song on the mix.
My shit right here. A-Track didn't ask me to rap on this shit. It wasn't no favor, none of that shit. I wanted to get this. This is my shit. I love this song right here. This is Kid's sister. Got a toes done up with a fingernail scratch. Got a toes done up with a fingernail scratch. Got a toes done up with a fingernail scratch. Toes done up with a fingernail scratch. Got a toes done up with a fingernail scratch.
This doesn't have any meaning. I just think that Melissa would like it. I'm always doing that. I'll hear some song and like it, and wonder if Melissa will like it too. The end.
Our next reader this evening is Matthew Henry, a first-year grad student extraordinaire. He enjoys long walks, jazz, and hot tea. He is incredibly handsome, intelligent, and modest. Matthew.
Herbert Crawford goes to International Falls. Herbert Crawford collapsed against a pine tree, breathing heavily. His eyes darted from tree to tree, his head twisting over his shoulders so violently his neck popped. He clutched the pine tree for support and rose again to his feet. His sap-covered hands were raw and filthy. Deep cuts crossed his palms, each filled with a mixture of dirt, sap, and blood. He staggered onward, and onward, and onward. 2 days of mushroom and berry subsistence later, he staggered into a town. It was a cozy town, with cottage-lined lanes and a downtown consisting of a school, a church, a bank, the town hall, and a diner. Herbert Crawford saw the diner, a crumbling brick structure with a faded sign hanging over the door that proclaimed it a festival of smells. A happy nose is our guarantee. Herbert Crawford clutched his torn parka and made his way inside. The warm air, laden with the smell of stale pies, old roast, raw potatoes, burnt chicken, greasy hamburgers, and rotten asparagus, assaulted him as he opened the door. A plump woman in her 40s, with a lurid floral dress and a southern accent, led him to one of the four tables. She handed him a menu and then went to talk to the cook. Herbert Crawford was the only customer. After scarfing down a meal of tough steak and chewy string beans, Herbert Crawford opened his wallet and discovered that it contained two $1 bills. His eyes widened in shock, and he stared in panic at the waitress. Slowly, with trembling fingers, he handed her his American Express. "Could I see your ID, honey?" Herbert Crawford was now shaking so hard that he knocked over his water glass. He handed her his driver's license. "So you're..." Her makeup-encrusted face contorted as she squinted at the credit card. "Robert Lawford, then?" His eyes shot to the door, and he turned to check each window before he returned his attention to her. "Actually, Herbert Crawford..." "What's that, honey? You'll have to speak up. I'm a little hard of hearing." "My name..." He swallowed. "My name is..." Again, the furtive glances to the exits. "My name is Herbert Crawford." "Well, Mr. Crawford..." Her voice dropped two octaves, and she reached a hand into her apron pocket. "You've just..." Herbert was on his feet in an instant, and he bowled the cross-dresser over as he ran to the door. He was across the town square in 30 seconds, and in 30 more, he was at the edge of town. A small path led into the forest, and he plunged into the woods without hesitation. The roaring of water drowned out the pounding of his feet. Then Herbert Crawford was no longer in the pines, but was stumbling through the slushy mud that followed the course of the river. He chanced to look over his shoulder at the exact moment his foot caught a root. The last thing he saw before he plunged into the icy river was that the man had lost his wig, and he did not look happy. Herbert Crawford was tossed and hurled about by the currents, and only through sheer luck did he manage to catch himself on a branch near the shore. A distant booming sounded behind him, and he discovered that the river ended a mere 30 feet from his branch. A waterfall, certain death if his numb limbs should fail him. But try as he might, Herbert Crawford was losing his grip. Mere seconds before his fingers gave way, a hand reached out and grabbed his wrist. He was hauled out of the frigid currents and dumped into the mud. A wet piece of paper was thrown onto his face. "Mr. Crawford," panted the man in the dress, "you've been served."
We'll be right back.
Thanks again to Trent Fast from right here in Mankato, playing for us an original track he composed called International Falls. You can catch him and his band this Saturday night at Max Barn Cafe.
Jonathan Heide loves pine trees, the river, and listening to Ira Glass on Sundays while driving. He has seasonal affective disorder in the summer, when it is too hot to move without raining sweat. He's studying technical communications at MSU. Jonathan.
Stu worked for a tree company called Tree Barbers 2 years. He had never held a job longer than 6 months, so he felt confident that cutting trees would be his life's work. He grumbled about it every day while driving the chip truck to his coworker, Jen, who rarely replied. "Too hot today, Jen," he'd yell over the banjos on the radio. They always listened to bluegrass in the morning. Only one speaker in the truck worked, though, and it was 6 inches from Steve's ear, so he shouted whenever he was driving. "Why are you wearing your hard hat in the truck?" Stu hollered to Jen as they turned onto 46th Street and headed west. Jen reached up and tapped her orange hard hat with her gloved finger. "Because you're a sucky driver, you moron," Jen replied, and then spit another wad of chew into her styrofoam cup. Stu loved her secretly, but he never looked her in the eye. He knew he loved her because one time she spit her snus in his coffee while he was taking a hard left turn. He didn't see her do it, so he drank the coffee. She laughed so hard she spit all over the windshield. "You're such an oaf," she yelled and told the rest of the crew about it after they got to the job. Normally, Stu would kill a person for that stunt. But with Jen, he just laughed. He and Jen pulled up to the job site to meet their boss, Elmer, and the rest of the crew one afternoon after climbing a red oak. They found fire trucks were at the address. Their boss had fallen from the huge elm, 50 feet from the ground. He cut his rope. He crashed through the skylight of the house and landed in a bed next to a lady who had been sleeping. He fell so hard he bounced off the mattress and crashed out of another window before landing on the pavement. The crew stood around. Stu said, "His name was Elmer, and he fell out of an elm." They all agreed it served as a eulogy. Stu watched the news that night crying. The Channel 5 crew interviewed the woman, still in her nightgown, and she told the horrifying experience with eyes wide and wild gestures. "Then there was this crash, and this guy bounced right off my bed and out the window." Student missed his boss. He missed climbing. He got up to pee and listened to the news with the door open when he heard about a storm up north. "And some really stormy winds have blown down the tallest red pine," the announcer said with cheer. Stu leaned back to catch the story, and his pee stream drifted out of the bowl. He held the door frame and peered, straining his neck to see the TV in the other room. A loop of video footage replayed large logs of pine being cut by forest rangers. The newscaster told of strong winds by Itasca blowing down the tallest red pine. DNR officials say it was the tallest tree in the state at 212 feet, about as tall as the Forshade Tower. Stu knew in an instant what he had to do. He looked back to find he had peed all over the floor and cursed as he slipped and fell. Stu drove down the pitch-black, woodsy road after driving 3.5 hours to International Falls. Stu's grandpa lived in a cabin as a little boy, and it had always stayed in the family. His grandma, Velma, had passed 10 years earlier after being trampled by llamas in Peru. Eugene, his grandpa, was more of a homebody, traveling only from home for cheaper medication into Canada. Stu pulled into the snow-covered driveway and shut off the headlights. He grabbed his ropes, his harness from the back, and walked through the unshoveled snow to the door. Smoke drifted from the chimney in the moonlight. Stu rapped on the door. Clanging ensued inside, the clicking of latches and loud cursing. The door opened, and Eugene stood squinting, wearing only his long underwear, which was worn enough to be transparent. "The hell are you?" he said. "Grandpa, it's me, Stu." "Stu, thought you were locked up. Get in here, I'm losing heat." The old man apparently hadn't been visited by anyone for a year because the place reeked. Eugene later told him he often wet his bed and pooped out the window by dragging a chair over to it and opening the window and dropping the load outside. Eugene had venison in a cast iron pan cooking on the wood stove. They ate the venison together. Eugene farted all night while Stu slept at the foot of his bed in a festival of smells, a true olfactory carnival of disgust. In the morning, the old man, hunched over, mumbling to himself, led Stu through the woods for 4 hours. The sun shone bright and the temp warm to 15 degrees as they tromped through the knee-deep snow. "You sure you remember where it's at, Gramps?" Stu called to Eugene. "Shut your face, you whippersnapper," Eugene replied. "Here it is! Boy, she's a beauty!" He tilted back his head and panned his vision to the sky. Stu whooped and hollered when he saw the massive trunk. They both strapped on their spikes and harnesses, tied their knots, and started to ascend. Stu clipped his buck strap and braced his weight against it, then plugged his spikes into the trunk. Each made a dull thud as he moved upward, deftly maneuvering around the limbs. Eugene's ancient frame, like a giant chipmunk, wound up the tree. They climbed for an hour before reaching the top. In a rush of passion, Stu began to hug the crown of the tree, then kissing the tree. They strapped into the tree and swayed with the wind, the old man's voice hollering from below, the wind rushing through the needles of the tree in a whoosh. "Tallest pine in the state," Stu yelled. "I can see the edge of International Falls from here."
Next writer this evening is Amy Flatabow. She did not write this. She was possessed by an evil muse with little swirly horns made of fuzzy purple pipe cleaners. She apologizes for what the muse did. Amy Flatabow.
Zippy was out there again. He was thinking about the pathetic state of his life, his boring, whitewashed cubicle of an apartment. He thought of the 3 lame books on his shelf, the complete deep space edition of Star Trek trivia, 999 baby names, and 1 million tiny pieces by James Fry. He thought of his painfully practical IKEA futon, his teal and pastel confetti pattern comforter, and the beige carpet without a single stain. Maybe if he had ever had one party in his life, in some corner near the couch, there would be at least a little faded red wine spot. But Zippy never spilled, and he never drank wine, nor did he ever have any friends. At least one of those would have to exist to result in any carpet flaws. Zippy thought about his job at the dry cleaner. That festival of smells constantly reminded him of all the smells he wasn't creating. He gathered strangers' dirties, their unmentionables, their clothes stained from a life worth living, and he dreamed of making one himself. Zippy wanted ketchup on his ties, olive oil on his pants, and embarrassing drips in his underwear. He wanted to wipe sweat off his brow and emit body odor from his armpits. But Zippy's life was the epitome of dull. His body never perspired. The most exciting thing about Zippy was his name, and Zippy was well aware of that, which is why he was out there again, at the edge of International Falls, thinking about jumping and ending the lame, confetti-patterned, odorless life he was leading. He shimmied further out, gripping the railing, pondering life after death. Would the whole scene just disappear? All his thoughts, these falls, the apartment, the dry cleaner, would it fade away to a black screen of nothingness? Or would there be some slick, swooping angels who snag his shirt collar just seconds before the splash to raise him up to the heavens where the clouds would open up and the music would be cued, a beautiful banjo quartet of those monkey-faced guys led by Spock, and he would dance his way in arm with friends, holding glasses of red wine, spilling bits upon the clouds with every merry swing of their bodies. They would dance and dance and then dine on elegant mahogany tables lined with vats of ketchup. Armed with fat spoons, they would slurp the sugary tomato goodness into their mouths and smear it upon their ties. And then they would go swimming in pools of olive oil. And then they would dance some more, and that would make them sweat. Zippy and all his friends would smell bad together in this beautiful place. Zippy wondered if that was possible, and then realized he was crazy, and pulled his hands off the railing, backed away from the falls, and walked to the dry cleaner and put in his 2 weeks' notice.
All right.
Jim Burt,
also known as Kenneth J., sometimes Ken, but never Jimmy, and usually just Bert, is here in Mankato trying to learn how to write this better. Kenny, you're up.
2 weeks ago, I got kicked out of my band. Well, it wasn't really a band. It was a banjo quartet. I don't know what the official definition of a band is, but I'm pretty sure it's not four guys standing around plucking the bottom of snare drums that have fretted necks attached to them. But then, if a guy with a guitar and another guy with a keyboard can be called a band, I suppose anything can. Back when people hauled around giant bass drums on their backs with cowbells and whistles and washboards on their chests and maybe even a jerry-rigged hi-hat tied to their feet, at least they had the decency to call themselves a one-man band. Isn't a two-man band called a duo? Was Seals and Cross a duo or a band? Who? Never mind. Let's try Simon and Garfunkel. Band or duo? How about the White Stripes? Well, they've got drums. I think you have to have drums to be a band. Actually, I think you have to have at least two melodic instruments, plus the drums, to be called a band. Of course, some drummers are melodic, but that's a whole other conversation. So technically, the White Stripes are not a band. But they're not really a duo either. The world needs new words. Of course, Jack and Meg can kick out the same amount of sonic whoopee as a real band, so I guess let him have the definition. What do I care? I was in a quartet. Try defining that up at the Lonesome Lasso Country and Western Bar out at the edge of the International Falls. That's in Minnesota, by the way. Coldest place in the country, I'm told. I don't know for sure if there really is a waterfall up there, but if the White Stripes can be called a band, then they can call their chilly little town International Falls if they want to. What do I care? I bet they've never even seen a banjo quartet up there. There aren't many, which is understandable. I mean, once you've done that Deliverance tune, you might as well pack up and go home. It's the only thing anybody wants to hear. Once we did the theme from Rossini's Barber of Seville, figuring everyone would remember the Bugs Bunny cartoon where he and Elmer Fudd are going at it back and forth across the stage, but it only went over their heads. Some kid in the back yelled, "Do the pig squealing song!" I felt like delivering my banjo upon his head until he squealed like a pig. Although it certainly was a change from the usual call for Freebird back when I was in a real band. We had drums and two melodic instruments. But that's called a trio, isn't it? Rush was a trio, power trio. Maybe you need the power in front of it. Peter, Paul, and Mary were a trio. They certainly weren't a band, no drums. If the White Stripes added a bass player, would they be a band or a trio? Or both? They're already a band, right? The world needs new words. The world needs a word for the emotional state of someone who was recently kicked out of his band. Well, quartet. So now they're a banjo trio, I guess. Good luck with that. What can you do with only three banjos? Maybe I'll find a drummer and form a banjo band. I bet we could do Freebird. I bet it would go over great up in International Falls.
That's Tales from the Poorhouse for this time. Thanks to KMSU, and thanks so much to the English Department at Mankato State University. We'll see you next time.
Sitting in a living room, sitting on the porch, it's your words gonna light that torch. Tell it in a city park, tell it in a bar, tell it in the backseat of your grandma's car. No tales too pure, our failures lure. The poorhouse sure wants to hear what's bubbling.